Today I will be reading from Ecclesiastes 12, verse 13. Now all has been heard. Here is the conclusion of the matter. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man.
Good morning, everybody. A little bit earlier than normal. Hope that's all right. I had a thought. I was standing back there. I usually stand back there just for a minute and collect myself, review my notes, and had a thought that I'm not sure almost how when to stop, because usually I know what time at a certain time in our normal time just kind of tone it down. Now I'm all off, so I may preach. No, I have a timer. Don't worry, I'm not going to preach too long. We will get the potluck. Have no fear. Anyway, it's good to see you this morning. I hope you all have had a good week. It's a good week. It was an interesting week. The more and more that, the longer I do this, it's just interesting, because sometimes I have no idea what the weeks will hold. This week I got, like the announcement said, very involved. I went to a hospice seminar that thankfully only had about 30 minutes of medical jargon I didn't understand, which was a very nice surprise, but got involved and met a lot of people there. I tell you that because people aren't always excited when they meet me and say, "Oh, what do you do? I'm a minister." Sometimes it's the whole, "Oh, really?" Or oftentimes the other one I get is, "Oh, well, I go to the so-and-so church." And I go, "I didn't ask." But it was nice that they were excited that someone in the ministry would be willing to come and help and be a part of their lives and be a part of their program and try to do things that are beneficial and good. In their minds, it's to help people with the aspects of being in the hospital and the end of life. But to me, it's an entirely different matter, as I think it might be to you. Because when people are obviously in the hospital, when they're near the end of their life, a lot of people begin to think of things like, what's the meaning of life? You know, the simple questions that we ask when we eat our cereal on Saturday morning cartoons. Not really. It's interesting that if you were to ask 5 different people, 10 different people, 20 different people, what is the meaning of life, you would get probably 30 different answers. Depending on how you phrase it, too, possibly. If you were to ask, what's the meaning of life? You might get a whole bunch of things. What's the point of mankind? What's the reason we're created? What's the goal of living? What's the reason we're made as we've been made? You don't have to answer. I would be curious what thoughts come to your mind when you hear that. In this crowd, it might be a little more attuned to my own worldview. But if you go anywhere to anyone, ask people randomly on the street. Actually, I think I might do this year. Go to BH, Silas, where'd you go? And just do the random, where'd he go? Silas! The random survey of people. It might be very, very fascinating. Because you will get a whole lot of answers. You will have probably a few different answers in this group. But especially whenever we start to diversify into people from different cities, other countries, from other cultures, who have been raised in different ways, who have 1, 2, or no parents. When you have different family dynamics, this changes quite a bit. The thing is also, we take one more step out onto the whole view of this, how we might answer that, in fact, how we answer that question, what's the meaning of life, is directly affected by our view of God, or, lowercase g, the gods, if you get my drift. For instance, if we're a Platonist, which comes from the philosopher Plato, we would answer that there really are no gods and the meaning of life is to pursue a higher knowledge. There are many gods, but we don't know what they want, so we just need to try to raise up above and pursue the higher knowledge there is. Well, his student Aristotle actually had a little bit of a different approach. He said it's not enough just to know things, but you actually have to act on them. The higher virtues, for those of you familiar with Aristotelianism. He said it's not enough. You have to actually act. You have to actually implement the virtues upon your life. This is, of course, then different from Epicureanism, from the philosopher Epicurus, which basically, come down to a nutshell, means, he says, eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. How many of us have heard that in this world? This is a little bit different from the Stoic mindset, which is the goal of life is to be free from suffering through orderly, objective living. Isn't that a little bit of a... I don't know if that means anything to you or not. Basically, Stoics want to take control of everything the best they can, and that will free them from living. That eventually evolved into more of the Buddhist mentality. Utilitarianism subscribes to the greatest happiness principle, which basically says that you should do whatever creates the best and the most amount of happiness for the most people. Obviously, the question is, well, how do you define that? Of course, there's nihilism, which is there's no objective meaning. There's no higher meaning, and whatever your meaning is, that's just fine. Which gives rise to existentialism, absurdism, holy cow, I'm a little bit tongue-tied today, absurdism, and postmodernism. That's a lot of isms, granted. What I want you to simply see is that throughout history, and I know that we're aware of this, there have been many different philosophies of life with different goals and different purposes and different meanings and different ways of interpreting things. This is directly influenced by our view of God. For instance, atheism, meaning there is no God, therefore there is no influence. Or perhaps agnosticism, which says there's probably no God, but I'm not sure, so I'll live well and hope for the best. There's deism, which says, if there are any gods at all, they're too far away to really be concerned with anything we do, so just live your life as you will. Pantheism means everything is spiritual in some way, that everything in its own way connects to some sort of god. There's Gnosticism, which says nothing physical is good, knowledge is spiritual. And then there's naturalism, which says God is in the material things. Contradictions all around. And the list goes on. Like I said, a lot of isms, you don't have to remember any of those. If nothing else, and I know you know this, there are a lot of contradicting, interesting worldviews out there. How many of us have encountered more than one of those other philosophies in the world? You don't have to look far, do you? So my question is, why is knowing, one, if there is a purpose, and two, what that purpose is, so important? Or is it important? There's actually a logic out there, I can't remember the exact name, but basically says there's no point to asking this question. Something like logical, I can't remember it. Anyway, there's actually a worldview out there that says we shouldn't even ask this question, just live because you're here and have fun. How about to you? Why is knowing if there is a purpose and to knowing that purpose important to you? Or is it? I think it's important because purpose affects everything. For instance, why were the cookies baked? Just because? Did they just appear? Did someone bring them? Or are they for a much higher, nobler purpose, like potluck? I invite you to Ecclesiastes for a minute. I want to take a quick tour through this book. This book is written by Solomon. And it's generally thought this is more towards the end of his life. Solomon, as we know, as many of us know, was regarded as the wisest person in Scripture. But even he is not safe from worldly philosophies and worldviews. In Ecclesiastes 1, he starts out by saying, "Vanity of vanity," says the preacher, "all is vanity." What a way to start out a book. In some translation, it actually says, "Meaningless! Everything is meaningless." He says, what does man gain by all of his toil? In 1 verse 3, which he toils under the sun. A generation goes, a generation comes. The earth remains. The sun rises, the sun goes down, hastens to its place where it rises. The wind blows to the south, it blows around to the north. Around and around goes the wind. And on its circuits the winds return. All streams run to the sea, but the sea isn't full. To the place where the streams flow, there, they'll flow again. All things are full of weariness. A man cannot utter it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing. What has been is what will be, and what is done is what will be. There is nothing new under the sun. Clinically, we might call this depression nowadays. But he's actually making an interesting point. He's trying to think existentially, which just means, what's the purpose of, well, everything? And eventually he comes around to, what's the point of living? In chapter 1, verse 12, he says, I, the preacher, have been king over Israel in Jerusalem, and I applied my heart, he says, to seek out and search out by wisdom all that is done under heaven. How many people have undertaken that very same goal today? This is nothing which is unique to us in the church. This is nothing new to those, or unique to those in the modern day century. People have been trying to search out the meaning of life forever. And he says, I've seen everything done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity. All is meaningless. All is nothing. And he starts to expound upon this a little bit. If you go with me, we're going to take a quick tour through Ecclesiastes, as I said. If you turn the page to chapter 2, verse 1, he says, I said to my heart, chapter 2, verse 1, come now, I will test you with pleasure. Enjoy yourself. Epicureanism. But behold, this also is vanity. I said of laughter, it is mad. And of pleasure, what use is it? So he says, I searched with my heart how to cheer my body with wine. My heart still guiding me with wisdom. A lot of that going on as well. And to lay hold on folly till I might see what was good for the children of man to do under heaven during the few days of their life. He says, I made great works. I built houses and planted vineyards for myself. I made gardens and parks. I made for myself all kinds of fruit trees. I made myself pools to which, from which to water the forest of growing trees. I bought male and female slaves, and I had slaves who were born in my house. I had great possessions of herds and flocks, more than any who came before me in Jerusalem. I also was rich. I gathered for myself silver and gold and the treasure of kings and provinces. I got singers, both men and women, and many concubines, the delight of the sons of man. So I became great, he says, and surpassed all who were before me in Jerusalem. Isn't this what our, even today, our modern day society says, yes, this is what we want, this is what we need, this is what we go for. Yes? And he says, then I considered all that my hands had done, in verse 11, and the toil I had expanded in doing it, and behold, all was vanity, all was meaningless. Solomon says the answer is not there. So he says, I turned to wisdom in verse 12, and madness and folly, for what can man do who comes after the king? Only what has already been done. He says, perhaps there's more wisdom and folly, and eventually he says, that's meaningless as well. In chapter 5, verse 10, he says, he who loves money will not be satisfied with money, nor he who loves wealth with his income. This also is vanity. He says, I tried possessions, I tried wealth, I tried pleasurable company and pleasure, I tried laughter, I tried knowledge. And you're getting the point. He says, all of it is worth nothing. And finally, in about chapter 9, he asks the question, why? Why is it all nothing? Chapter 9, he says, but all this I laid to heart, examining it all, how the righteous and the wise and their deeds are in the hand of God. Whether it is love or hate, man does not know. Both are before him. It is the same for all, Solomon says, since the same event, the same event happens to the righteous and to the wicked, to the good and to the evil, to the clean and to the unclean, to him who sacrifices and to him who does not sacrifice. As the good one is, so is the sinner. He who swears as he is who shuns an oath. What is he talking about? He's talking about death. He says anything and everything in this world that you can accumulate that is in this world really in the end means nothing, because no matter if you were good while you were doing it, if you were bad while you were doing it, if you were a sinner, if you were a righteous man, if you were wealthy and unwealthy, put any two comparisons you want, death comes to all people. So many people nowadays, not just nowadays, people throughout history have wrestled with this question and come to the same conclusion, hoping something that they do, something that they are, something they built. Why do you think great kings have wanted to build palaces and temples and great things that will hopefully last through the ages? Because they won't. Solomon finally gets it right, though. When he wrote what Wyatt read for us, he says in 12:13, "The end of the matter, all has been heard." He says, "Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man." This word fear, it has two meanings in the Old Testament. Actually, it has more than that. But generally, it means two things in the Old Testament. Either it meant literally fear, as in, God's coming! Shape up! Or it meant out of fear, meaning more to revere, to respect, and to obey. Has anyone ever had either a boss or a teacher or maybe a parent who you feared in the sense that you were almost intimidated by because they were so fill in the blank, so knowledgeable, so holy, so good, so whatever, that you feared them not in the sense that you were actually scared of them, but you were intimidated by them because you wanted to be like them? Kind of the same thing about how this word fear means in the Old Testament. So Solomon tries everything in this world, basically, and says there's nothing except one thing, to fear God and to keep his commandments. But the thing is, that still doesn't answer why. Solomon does not answer still the question of why we are created. He says, why we're created cannot be these things of which mean nothing. Why were we created cannot be to gain wealth, to gain pleasure, to gain knowledge, to gain wisdom. It cannot be any of these things because they mean nothing. So we're still left with the question of why. It's important to know why. Why? I remember growing up, I remember so many times, I was one of those, it seems to be everyone nowadays, but I remember thinking at probably age 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, that my parents really knew nothing. It's okay, you'll learn too. Mark Twain has a quote that he says, "When I was 15 or so, he was amazed at how ignorant his father was. But at 21, I was amazed how much he had learned in 6 years. How many times as a child were we told no without any explanation? But as a parent, we know or have told our kids no because we knew that it was better for them. As an adult, we look back and go, well, I obeyed or I didn't. Not because I understood, but because out of respect, out of fear maybe, out of obedience. But now as an adult, one of the fun things, or maybe not fun things, about being an adult is that we have a better understanding of life. As an adult, we understand not to stick our fingers into the outlet. Not because Mama said not to do it, but because we understand what will happen. We understand the concept of electricity. We understand pain. We understand these things. We understand why it's not a good idea to ride in the roof of a car when, as a 5-year-old, we're going, why can't I? You just think your parents are killjoys when, in fact, they're going, no, we love you. There's a difference. There's a huge difference in knowing not to do something versus knowing why not to do that thing, yes? There's a huge difference in knowing about something and knowing actually why that something is. There's a deeper understanding, not something we have to sit there and wrestle with when it comes to the outlet. We no longer have to sit there and stare and go, you know, I want to. Why shouldn't I? We know it. We understand it. We live with it. It's just become a part of us. It's interesting because Israel had this same question, had this same conundrum when it came to their relationship with God. Israel over and over and over messed up, and over and over and over, just read Judges, God came back to them. And eventually, oftentimes, they would go, God, why don't you actually do for us? Why don't you actually treat us special? Why don't you actually do these things? Well, you know, why can't we do what we want? And God says, one, you're not my pets, you're my chosen people. But that means I hold you to a higher standard. But two, he says, Israel, you're missing the whole point of why you're my chosen people. The whole point of my chosen people is not just so I can give you blessings and not just so that way you can be happy, but the whole point of me choosing you, Israel, was so that way you could be the light among the nations to say that I am real. Isaiah 43:7 says exactly this. Isaiah 43:7, and this is in the context of Amhinash, you're talking about Israel, says, you and your sons and daughters and everyone who are far off were created, why? He says, for my glory. For my glory. In a sense, he says, your purpose, Israel, your purpose of why I created you, why you are who you are, is for my glory. This word glory is an interesting word. It means intrinsic value. It means an external. Value cannot come from something external, but because it is valuable. When he says you're created for my glory, he says you are created for my value. You're created for my purpose. You're created for my reasoning. As God, as Creator, as Alpha and Omega. And that's all you need to know. Here's a question. Can you live without a purpose? Actually, take a minute and think about it. Can you live without a purpose? Because people are. People are nowadays. In Genesis 1:27, a scripture which we're very familiar with, it says that God created us, man, womankind, in His own image. We've discussed this before, but it's always worth returning to. What does image mean? It means to be like. It means to be reminiscent of. It means to have attributes of. It means to be made similarly to. Now, we don't have all the aspects of God, obviously, but what we do have, when we look at ourselves, we can say it came from God. His creativity, His love, His compassion, His thirst for knowledge, His artistic ability. All these things we can say came from God because that reflects the image of God. When it comes to purpose, when it comes to why we are here, why we are created, Proverbs 16:4 says the exact same thing, is that we are created for His purpose. Ephesians 2:10 takes it a little bit further and says we are actually created for His good works in Christ Jesus, meaning we are created in His image to do the things that He would like us to do, things that He would do like God. Sometimes I fear that we are told so often, or at least we remember so often, or perhaps that we remember so often, that yes, we're created in the image of God, and yes, He created us for a reason, that sometimes we forget how important that is to us, how important that is to the world, how important that is to our lives, how important that is to how we treat each other, how important that is to simply waking up every morning. When was the last time you actually sat there and really let it wash over you as you woke up in the morning, or as you looked at a sunset or a sunrise, or saw the beauty of the trees, or even just had something yummy, eat, put a steak in your mouth, and you go, this is so good. That God created you like Him for His glory, for His reason, for His purpose, because of, for, and out of His value. And how many people wish they had the luxury of being able to go, oh yeah, I know that. How many people out there wish that they had an assurance of the fact that when they woke up that morning, that they are valuable. That they are here because of something rather than just by chance. And that means they have a purpose for their life, a goal, a value. That their life is not just vanity and not just meaningless, not just something that will wash away in the wind or blow away in the wind, but actually have something that will stick around for eternity. I remind you of this morning because this is an interesting time for purpose. We get wrapped up in things like elections, politics, finances, different worldviews competing, different things of being able to do. We studied the first century church. We looked at some of how they operated. Sometimes we get caught up so much in doing and so much in trying to be something that we forget to stop and think for a minute and remind ourselves and rest in the knowledge and be refreshed by and be emboldened by and be encouraged by the fact that we also, like Israel, like everyone in this world, has been created for God's glory, has been created for His purpose, has been created to be like Him, and that makes us intrinsically valuable, not because of money, wealth, food, pleasure, anything like that, not how much we know, not how much we make, not how many even kids we have, not where we go to church, nothing like that, but because simply we are valuable, that we have purpose. That we're here, not because of vanity, but for some, as a potential force in this world. I haven't been asked this yet by my two sons, but eventually I'm preparing for that inevitable question, Dad, why am I here? I have two answers to that, and I haven't talked about this with Amy, but I have two answers. One is because God wanted you to be. And two is because I wanted you to be. In my mind, those two questions, those two answers, to me at least, gave me such encouragement, gave me such hope that no matter what I see in this world, that for those who strive towards God, like Paul, striving towards the goal, not being influenced by these worldly things that are all vanity, but yet we can still attain our purpose. You know, it's interesting, talking about hospice and talking about hospital stuff, oftentimes when people are sick and disease-like and dying, oftentimes we say that, you know what, poor old Joe, he's just a shadow of his former self. You've heard this before, maybe you've said it before. The amazing thing to me, church, is that for those of us who have yet to figure out, or for those of us who are still yet striving for this purpose, for this goal, to live up and be able to explore potentially this value that we have, that we do have, we can say we are shadows of our future selves. We can say that anything that we've done or anything that we are before Jesus, it's just the ingredients before they get combined to make the dough. And that in Jesus, in Christ, we can begin to strive towards our purpose, strive towards strive towards that amazing image of God that we can spend all life. And God says it's a life not wasted to strive towards maintaining and becoming and fulfilling that huge potential that we have, fulfilling that huge purpose that we have. And that's simply, it's huge, but it's simply to keep God's commandments and live like Jesus. What does this do to us? What does this do to us in our lives? What does this do to us, to each other? What does this do to our life? What does this do to our society that God purposed, planned, and gave meaning? It says that no one is meaningless. Not the girl who was abused by her dad. Not the young mom who got kicked out of her apartment because she couldn't pay her rent. Not the father, which is trying to figure things out. Not someone who lost their job. No one is meaningless. It means that no one is without purpose. No one is worthless. No one is forgotten. No one is born terrible. No one's life is less than others. And that no one is ever truly left behind as long as God is God. These are big things. I'm speaking at a fairly general level, but I really want, this is the whole point of this sermon today. I really want to bring it down to you. In your walk, your view, your two eyes, your heart. For many of you in here, I've said nothing that you didn't already know. Hopefully I've reminded you about it. Hopefully I've given you a little bit of an appreciation for it. Being reminded about things is good. But I want you to really, here's the part to tune in. What in your life? What in your life? Who in your life needs to be affected by the fact that God has made them or it valuable? What aspect of your own life do you need to actually commit and believe that because you are valuable, this should happen? Who in your life? Who do you find, who do you see, who do you walk with, who do you talk with, that needs to be reminded of the fact that God has made them valuable too? Who in this room? Which relationship in this room needs to be changed because God views both of you as valuable? God has purposed to be like Jesus for both of you, and that both of you are striving towards it together. How would Jesus not knowing his purpose in life affected his ministry? How would Jesus's not knowing his purpose affected his ministry? How was he able to resist temptation? How was he able to follow through on a horrible death that he knew about? How was he able to do what he did? I think it comes down to several things, all of which combine. He truly knew God. He knew what it meant to have that relationship, and Jesus knew his purpose. Jesus knew his value, not just to God, but to everyone in this world. And Jesus knew that that belief equals trust, which equals action on that trust, which equals transformation into the image of God. I leave it before you today. As I said, probably nothing new today per se. But I want you to realize that like the cookies, which depending on why they're made, affect how they're used, our perception of value not only changes who we are, but our perception of our value and purpose should change every aspect of our life, should change every relationship that we have, should change every person we meet, should change anything and everything that we do. Because we weren't just made to be vanity. We weren't just made to fly off of the wind. We were made to fulfill an eternal purpose that God said, I want you to do and want you to be. And that
is a life worth living?
A life that fears God and keeps His commandments,
that actually goes out and is unafraid to act like the treasure that we are in God's eyes, and that treats everyone they meet with the same value because they have the same value, and shows the light of purpose and meaning to the world, that is a life worth living.
What we're about to do, and I don't want to take away anything from Paul's talk, is also a reflection of that value. The fact that Jesus deemed all of you valuable enough to come and die for you is what we remember when we take communion.
The fact that the reason that we're here, the fact that we exist, whenever we take the bread and take the juice, we say to each other, we still believe, but we also remind each other that the person sitting across the aisle, the person sitting in front of us in the row, the person sitting behind us, no matter who they are, is indeed valuable and has the same purpose we do. And we're united in that purpose because we commune together in Jesus. Even as we come to this, I invite you to ask the question, what needs to change? Or how can things be different in the fact that you, I, we have value because we're made in the image of God? The lesson's yours.